Okay, so tonight's class is intellectual property and the internet. And we'll start off talking about the intellectual property as a whole, some issues involved in it, and then we'll get into some specific issues that come up when it comes to the internet and kind of modern times. And I mean, this is something that all of us deal with on some level. And I think maybe what makes it even more difficult in some ways is the privacy aspect to it. We've all been in a situation where we've been offered...
So this is Yosef.
Sorry.
That Yosef is looking for his brothers. Yaakov sends Yosef to go...
So we're offered something that we can... we're offered something that we can get for free. It could be a movie, it could be music, it could be software, right? People have all different types of, all different types of things that they have the option of getting for free. And there's a temptation. And there's a temptation to take advantage of that. And so we'll talk about some of the specific issues that come up with the with this issue, and then intellectual property as a whole. So source number one, something that Bella you were referring to earlier, is Rabbi Eliezer, further said the name of Rabbi Hanina, whoever reports a saying in the name of its originator brings deliverance to the world, as it says, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai. So this source in the Talmud, there's another source that's, you know, similar. Make the point that there is a value to making a statement in someone's name. And part of the issue here seems to be that there's an aspect of Gnevas Das, that if you don't mention in somebody's name, the implication is that you said it yourself, right? So there's a misleading aspect to it as well. Sorry, one second. Okay. So now this comes up in a lot of different cases. We're going to look through some historical cases that we can maybe compare and contrast a little bit and see how it works. So somebody want to read the number two? Bella, want to read number two?
If we were not to close the door in the face of other publishers, that is, prohibit competition, which fool would undertake the publication of Judaica and risk a financial loss, literally a loss of several thousands? The publication of Jewish works will cease, God forbid, and Torah study will be weakened. Therefore, for the benefit of the Jewish people and for the sake of the exaltation of the Torah, our early sages have enacted.
Okay, so this is the issue of the fear that if intellectual property is not protected, so then there'll be a loss, right? Or it will become a disincentive, remove the incentive to create. So we see this in a lot of different industries. I think especially we see it in where the pharmaceutical industry is very famous. The pharmaceutical industry, we talked about this during healthcare, in the healthcare debate, that they're given a 15-year head start, right? They're given a monopoly for 15 years before there can be a generic to compete. So why is that done? Because the feeling is, if we don't give an incentive to, if people won't profit from all of their hard work, then they won't go into the business in the first place. And so here the Chassam Sofer is saying that when it comes to Judaica, people are not going to go into publication or to writing new books or to taking risks if there is the fear that they will not be able to make a profit. Now, this is based on a case that happened about the writings of the Rambam. So there was a dispute amongst two people here. The names here. So there's Rabbi Meir Katzen Ellenbogen of Paduya, who's known as the Maharam. So he published an edition of the Mishneh Torah in 1550. And then right afterwards, there's a non-Jewish publisher who printed is the same exact work, but charge less. And the question was, should they ban the second printing, right? Because sometimes it's the, you know, what's original about the text. There's a lot of different things that can be original about the text. It could be the text itself, your own original work. It could be an original translation, but sometimes it's just the typeset or the layout, right? And now, and nowadays, in modern times, certainly in Jewish books, there's a whole big market on just writing a clear text, better typesets, right? Because a lot of the older versions of a lot of the commentaries are very hard to read. They're not well edited. They're not well structured. And now you have these whole new sets that make it much, much easier to read. And they've become very popular, and they've created a market for themselves. So here this debate rose, should they ban the second company? And so the Chassam Sofer is saying that, yes, we can ban this second the second printing from being sold in the Jewish community, because all it's doing is stealing the exact idea of the Maharam, and therefore he won't be getting any work, any of the benefit. So in the future, no one's going to go into this type of work, and it's going to be bad for all of us. So on some level, we have to protect someone's intellectual property just to make sure that we have the incentive for people.
In the course of Rabbi Maris, I remember hearing about a law that there had to be a 10-year separation between editions of classics.
Okay, so there you go, something like that. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I think that makes sense. This way, there's some sort of distance to make sure they have at least a certain amount of time that they have.
Israel, I think it's after 70 years, there is no any.
All right, that's the general law seven, of copyright, 70 years after the death of an author.
70 years?
Yes.
So after 70 years, anyone can reprint it.
Not only reprint it, like also
public domain. Rewrite.
Like, let's say Bialik wrote, so like again.
Right, so that has to do with original works. And here you're talking about...
So the, at that point it becomes public consumption. Right.
And what you were saying about the principle, you know, that's also in American copyright law.
Right. Right. So that's a big argument with the internet, especially with the internet, is the fear that a lot of industries will get hurt because it's free. Let's take newspapers, for example, right? So newspapers from the outset decided that they're going to offer free versions online, right? Might not have been the most forward-thinking decision on the newspaper industry, by the newspaper industry, because they probably didn't think, you know, I remember I read some articles, right when the internet was starting, 95, 96, starting to become popular. So, you know, some of the famous newspaper writers were saying things like, no, I think it's Newsweek, it's an article in Newsweek, like, don't worry, the sitting down in the morning with your paper and coffee, that will never end, right? They couldn't imagine a world in which you didn't sit down with the paper in the morning, that you went on the computer to see the news. So they just gave it out for free, right? And then what ended up happening is that a generation arises that's not used to the newspaper in the morning or doesn't care about the newspaper in the morning and are very happy to get it for free and not have it delivered every day, right? And so now I know the New York Times charges online, which, you know, so that basically every newspaper's, but the problem is, for the public good, it becomes a problem because now newspapers have closed, and magazines have closed, and those that world and those writers, you know, something's gonna get lost in the process. And yes, there's websites and maybe those writers will get employed by websites. But I think, you know, some people pointed out, I think it's a good point, that there's a value to a newsroom. There's a value to a bunch of people that are in the room together, right? You know, if you ever watch All the President's Men, right, about the Watergate scandal, a great movie. So a big part of the movie is the newsroom and the dynamic of the newsroom. And they have a question or they have an idea and they're sharing ideas with everybody else, and there's a value to that. So the internet has caused a lot of, some things are just because of the companies themselves, how they've handled or how they've marketed themselves. But sometimes when it comes to piracy, then you get into real fears of things being lost. I know the music industry was the first one to get really, really worried about this. Then TV became really worried about this because they felt they need to offer TV shows online. So then they now need, but then now they're going to get less marketing, you know, less advertising dollars. So then now they had to figure out how to get advertising dollars from the internet, which, you know, they're figuring out how to do. It's not that big a deal. And if you offer it for free with commercials, people will watch it typically over pirating it. When you don't offer it, then you're getting into the world of piracy. Movies, it's a little bit harder, although you have already Netflix and all these different options. But still, I feel like pirating movies is probably more popular, I don't know, than TV shows. I'm not sure. I don't know exactly what... maybe HBO gets pirated more, things like that, I guess. So it's always going to be a concern. But music, for sure, it's easier, the files are smaller. So this is a concern for any industry that if it becomes too easy to get for free, then they will lose it. Now, the Node de Behuda, source number 3, let me give you the background in this case. So the Node de Behuda, the 18th century rabbi who was the leader of the Jewish community in Prague and one of the greatest rabbis of the past 300 years, so he was dealing with a case. Sorry, let me open it up. So I'll just describe it. This is from RJJ Journal. The case addressed by Node de Behuda involved a scholar who authorized a Talmudic commentary and paid the publisher the stipulated amount for printing his work upon the margin page of the Talmud. After completion of the printing, I'll explain outside. So basically, somebody wrote a commentary in the Talmud. And in order to do so, to fit it in, they restructured the Tzura Sadaf. They restructured the page of the Talmud. And they did in a way that people really liked. So, you know, back in the printing press days, the typeset was a lot of work, right? Just create a typeset, create a structure. So they create this whole typeset, and he prints out the Talmud for this guy with his commentary. Now, his commentary doesn't make it big necessarily, but people really liked the look of the new Talmud. So the printer said, hey, I want to use the same typeset, print out the Talmud without the commentary, right? His intellectual property was his commentary. He paid me to do that. I did that for him. Now I have every right to produce a Talmud without his commentary in that same typeset. So that was the question brought to Node de Behuda. Is that considered stealing if he produces such a Talmud? So source number 3, this is Node de Behuda, volume 2, Choshe Mishpat number 24. So he, the printer, has caused a great loss to the author. For if the printer had not published these second books, there would have been a great demand for Reuven, the author's work, which include the Talmudic text. Now that Shimon, the printer, has printed his volumes, these volumes, which are cheap and in great supply, will reduce the demand for Reuven, the author's work. Since the printer has caused the author a financial loss, we obligate him to pay all that he benefited from the author's share in the typeset arrangement. So the Node de Behuda decides with the author and saying that, look, part of the appeal, part of the draw for this was the typeset. And if you're going to copy the entire product, now look, it's not even clear that it was the author who came up with this typeset. It was the publisher himself who came up with the typeset. It was his type, but he was paid to come up with the typeset. And the feeling was that since he was paid to do the job, his job was to print, and then whatever profits came from it. So this was seen as unfair competition to the author of this commentary. And so here we see how far the Node de Behuda goes to protect the rights, the intellectual property here. Because this is not even full intellectual property, right? He didn't even create the typeset. He merely commissioned the printer to come up with the typeset, and that's already considered his intellectual property because he paid for it. Interesting how far he goes here.
Today, you know, the contract would, you know, specify who owns what. Now also, you know, I have experience of getting a copyright on a book that I produced. You can't copyright a typeface because there are tiny differences between typefaces, but probably layout, you can. You can't claim copyright on a classic text like Tfilot, but
right.
You can claim copyright on how you enhanced it.
I wonder, like with websites, if you can copyright looks of websites, or you can copyright structures of websites. I don't know how that works. I don't know if there's such a thing. I know with music, you can copyright bars of music, I think, right? I mean, this comes up sometimes, right? You know, rappers all the time, especially now, they'll do something called, what's it called? Sampling, where they'll take from another song, or they'll take like a beat from another song and produce their song on top of it. And they'll use that as like a running beat. So, do you own the song? Do you own the beats of the song? Do you own the bars of the song? Like, what do you even own? So there, it seems like, you know, I think there's been some legal cases about that as well.
I mean, it can go far also, like, if you own the words. Let's say the song, he has some phrases. So right. He owns it, like, I can't use it.
Right.
It's very far, yeah.
Right, if I just start saying, imagine all the people living in this world, or start quoting John Lennon, am I suddenly... You know, am I guilty of, right? Or do you have to sing it in order to be, right? That's a good question, right? Exactly, right.
I will be dead.
What? Yeah.
If you sing the song of John Lennon, you can quote it, but if not...
Or opposite, you can quote it if you don't sing it, because then you're not stealing.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying. If I sung it, it wouldn't matter, because it wouldn't sound the same anyway, so...
I know with copyright of text, the percentage of the whole is a big factor.
How much are you taking?
Yeah, like if you're doing research on a database and you print out one abstract, you're not violating copyright. I chaired a conference on downloading. But if you download 50% of the database, you're violating copyright.
What kind of database?
And let's say a bibliographic database. Let's say all the articles in Jewish studies or all the articles in religion.
Oh, really?
But even in copyrights, you own what? The ideas? Let's say I...
No, you never own the ideas.
So what do you own?
Like, for example, there was a guy named Jane Fix who wrote a book about running, and 50 other people wrote a book about running. You can never copyright an idea. You're copyrighting the form, the form of the writing. So in other words, if somebody plagiarizes you, you can sue if you registered the copyright.
So if I say the same idea, but a little bit different the form... It's not a problem.
We'll get to plagiarism. But yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, that's L'Shem Omro already, right? That once you're quoting, for the most part. I mean, if yeah, we'll get to that at the end. Okay. Source number four. Okay, let me get out this case. Okay, so here is another case. So here is a case of a sitter. A sitter that, this is more about translation and editing of a sitter. So this is again more of a typeset issue. So source number four, the Chassam Sofer. If the case is so that limited protection is granted for printers of other texts already in the public domain, so much more so for one who created a new entity. For example, the consummate scholar Rabbi Wolf Heidenheim, who spent countless hours in the editing and translating of the piyutim. So he like put together this siddur that had all these piyutim, and he translated it well and kind of like brought them back to life. So people wanted to copy his siddur and say, look, it's a siddur. Again, this is public information. And why should others profit from his creativity? It, our case, can be compared to the case of the fisherman who by means of his action caused the gathering of the fish. So what's that? So look at source number five. So this is a Gemara in Bava Basra, 21b, Chaf Aleph Mabez. So Rav Huna said, if a resident of an alley set up a handmill and other residents of the alley want to set up one next to him, the first has the right to stop him because he can say to him, you're interfering with my livelihood. So here's the concept of Hasagas Gavul, that unfair competition or too much competition, based in has the right to stop because you can't, you know, you can't impoverish one person or both of you because the market can't handle, you know, two of the same thing.
You know what? I used to call Flushing like Hasagas Gvul Town because there were five pizza shops in the area. But then I learned a very interesting economic concept. If you own a gas station and I open one Katy Corner, it's not going to hurt you. We will both do more business because our street gets the reputation as the place to buy gas.
That's the diamond district, right? Right? Why does everyone have their diamond placed in the same half block? Right? It seems like a terrible idea. I thought the same thing when I first went there. I'm like, this is crazy. How does anybody sell anything? But if everyone knows to go here, then everyone benefits because all the traffic is there, right? Exactly. So that could be. So it doesn't... Opening another company doesn't mean that there will definitely be a second school, but it's possible. It
means case by case. There's another point.
Well, let me finish this. We didn't get to our point yet. So this is, may we say that this view is supported by the following. Fishing nets must be kept away from the hiding place of a fish, which has been spotted by another fisherman the full length of the fish's swim. So the commentaries debate what this means. Well, let's go a little further. And how much is this? Rabbi Rafuna said a parsing. Fishes are different because they look about for food. Hence, the fisherman who knows where the hole is places bait within the fish's swim. And if another does this, he is poaching on the preserves of the first. But this cannot be said when he sets up an opposition meal. So the case of the fisherman, which the Chassam Sofer is quoting, is that if a fisherman has been working at catching a certain fish or setting up a bait or setting up a trap, and they've worked hard to entice the fish to come to the area, you can't then come and swoop in and take the fish. Because since they already put in the work to bring the fish to them, to that area, now you are poaching. Right? Now, so that's, in a sense, his... Now look, a fish is public domain. No one owns the fish. So what right does anyone say you can't take these fish? It's public. So here we have, so there's a sense of intellectual property. That I put in the work to get the fish, I have a right to collect them, to catch them. Now look, if I think I'm doing a good job and I'm not, the fish swim away, and now they're, you know, a half mile down the road, down the river, so okay, now I don't own the fish, I can't stop you. But within my territory, within the area I'm working, I have a right to, you know, a monopoly of the area. So again, this is a type of, we don't want to create, we don't want to remove the incentive to create, to work, and to build. And so that is one issue that comes up here, and certainly one of the big issues that comes up with the internet. Now, as an aside, there's a discussion about the Haskamos in Svarim, right? That Svarim, at some point, I think like the 1500s, 1600s, they started writing Haskamos, like approbations in the beginning of a text. So why was that done? Why was that done? So there's two reasons given. One is, especially if it's an author who's less, not necessarily as famous as others, it was to give credibility, right? We trust this person, they're a Yerushalmayim, they know what they're talking about, this book has validity. But the second answer given was to protect the intellectual property, was that it was a way of making sure that people aren't copying from each other. So you needed to have the Haskamos, meaning that was, they're protecting that no one's copying anybody else's ideas, because you're going to have a hard time getting a Haskama if other people are doing the same thing and you're just copying it. Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to comment on source 4. Well, hi, Naomi. I'm actually working with this thing on the two kinds of trope for a Sarah Adivro. It's a very interesting concept in the field of information science. You know, you were talking about modern infringement machines, but a few decades ago, it was the Xerox machine.
Right.
And an interesting point made in the literature is that authors from the academic realm want their copyright violated. They want their articles photocopied frequently so that they'll be cited more.
I guess, yeah, in the internet world, that could be linking article, right? That people want their articles linked to quoted copyright. I mean, once you put your article on the internet, right, you can't really, as long as it's cited, you can't have any complaint that it's being used or quoted, right? And so to a certain extent, it helps, because, you know, the goal of the internet is to drive traffic. The more you can drive traffic, the better.
And I think some musicians feel that way, too.
I think they're coming around to that way of thinking. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking. Yeah, but I think they're coming around to that way of thinking a little bit. Yeah. This comes up. Sports leagues have this issue, right? That they differ on how to handle it. So, for example, Major League Baseball, they don't allow any of their highlights to be on YouTube. They block anybody who puts something on YouTube. they stated as a violation of copyrights removed because they want everybody coming to their website, MLB.com. But the NBA and the NFL are much more free about it. They don't care because they figure the more people that are viewing our content, the better it is for us. On our website, on YouTube, whatever, we don't really care as long as they're you know, accessing it, then we're expanding our base and getting people excited about our products. So you're right. So there's different ways of thinking about it. And some will just openly not care about copyright infringements in that way because they think it's better for them. You're right. Okay, so Rav Moshe talks about, you know, this is in 1979, so a more modern case for 1979, about copying tapes, right? So way back in the day, right, instead of MP3s, you had cassette tapes, and there were machines that had dual cassettes, and you press play on one and record on the other, and they would record from one to the other. It was like magic. So Rav Moshe was asked if this was allowed. So this is what he writes. So this tshuva is Or Chaim, the fourth volume of Or Chaim, number 40, and then subsection 19. So the Misha Osa tape Medivrei Torah Aser Latiko Bedavar Echad She Asa Tape Medivrei Torah Vekosev She Aser Lasas Me Tape Shelo O Tapes Vade Aser Kihu Inyan Shava Kesef. So this is not just a music tape, this is a Torah tape. So you think we're spreading Torah, what's wrong with that? So it says no, it's prohibited. Kihu Inyan Shava Kesef, it's equal to money. V'yaseh tape l'arviach mizeh she'acherim she'yirtzu yitztarchu l'shalim lo. So the person who sold the original tape made this tape to sell it. And so if you are copying it, then they're not selling it. She'im kein leka mishu midatzto. She'im kein leka mishu midatzto. So it's not that they're being obstinate. It's not that they're being like the people of stone, meaning like in Pirkei Avos, the people of stone, the Mida of stone is considered what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. So say, look, why did you say what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours? Zenen and Zelo Chaser, someone can benefit, you lose nothing. Why should we limit copying? Because it limits the person's ability to make money from what is a money making venture. And since it's his item, so you're not allowed to just reproduce it without permission. Even if you don't know for sure, right, that you don't have permission, unless there's explicit permission to do it, you can't just assume permission to do that. Kevin Shamar Zebirabim, she call echa yachol la tik al tape, ain lo shumer shidlim noah milas those tapes, im lo kesha amar, la kolel shibo lishmoa, she ain omer ella kesha tichulo, shliasu tape. So let's say someone gives a public lecture. So we're going to tape the public lecture, and then that reproduces. So then that's different. Once you do a public lecture, so then anyone could come. So then it's by definition for the masses. So once it's for the masses, then I can record it and then I can share it. However, I'm saying unless the person says in advance, you can't tape this, right? Sometimes, and I've been to classes before where they've said, I'm taping this and we're going to sell it, right? So therefore, please no one tape the class. So I've heard people say that before. So im lo kesha amar lekol elu shebal lishmoa she'ena omer elak shev tichulo shalosh tapes mizeh. Okay, so in here I think the important lesson is that you can say on one hand you can say that you're buying the property, but you don't buy the rights to the property. Okay, and this I think comes up a lot with, let's say, you know, Microsoft Office, right? Where, well, I own Microsoft Office. I bought the tape, the disc. So then why can't I give it to somebody else? I'll just give them the passcode and they'll do it, right? If I own it, why don't I have full rights to it? So here, Rav Moshe is championing the cause that you can own something and yet not own the rights to it. It's a very interesting concept, right? But I own this tape. I don't own the right to reproduce this tape. I own this book. I don't have the right to photocopy it and give it to somebody else. So that's a type of intellectual property. It's a little bit different than we said before. Before, we were talking about the actual intellectual property where someone's gonna produce the same thing or copy it. Here, even though you bought this legally, right? The other cases, people were on their own trying to make money off of it. I'm not even trying to make money off this. I'm not even reselling it. I am simply trying to share what is mine, right? If I have a book, I can lend it to someone and they can read it. That's not a problem. No one says I can't share books. If I have a DVD that I buy, I can give it to someone else to watch. That's not a problem.
But you know what? In England, authors get royalties on books loaned by libraries.
Each time it's loaned?
They claim that that hurts their finances.
Oh, really?
Only by libraries.
Because they lend the book to multiple people, so they feel they would sell more copies if not the libraries.
So they keep track of every time that book is taken out. So basically, they just tell their relatives to go take out their books every week.
That's cute.
Yeah. That was a devilish way of thinking about it. But okay, interesting. So the last case I want to talk about here is plagiarism. This is a very big issue. So my wife is a teacher, and so she deals with this very head on. And there's different types of plagiarism today. First, there's entire websites devoted to papers. Right, you're in college. I'm saying, how prevalent do you see this as people just downloading papers off the internet? Is that something
essays
you see? Yeah, essays, term papers.
If they can, they do it. I mean,
if they can, they will.
Yeah, but yeah.
If they can get away with it.
Me.
What?
I always require a description of the literature search. Nobody can take a paper from me from the web.
Oh, because they have to explain how they got to the point they got. Ah, so that's very good. So you're very aware of that possibility, right? Right, right, because it's so easy. But a lot of teachers and professors are not. I don't know why, but they're not. Is that what you're saying? You're saying so it's...
No, it's very hard to follow. It's very hard to do, yeah, what you do. I mean, let's say I found an article, whatever, in I don't know which website, and I read it, and I know how to go to the conclusion. I mean, I can explain you how did I go to the conclusion I get.
I'm saying, I teach information science, so I require a description of the literature search. In other words, they have to know what indexes, what databases, what search terms.
Oh, really? So you go to that? Oh, wow! So they have to get every step of the way. No, that's a good. So my wife encounters at both schools she's been in. When she reads a paper or a Dvar Torah or something, and it looks not quite, it looks a little too advanced, the writing, the concept, right? So all she does is she takes three words in consecutive words, Googles it, and then boom, there's h.com or there's Torah.org or whatever it is, right? And it's amazing. I mean, she'll almost always find it right away. And it's amazing. First, the students are shocked that they're caught. Shocked. They don't think a teacher's got the savvy to Google something. They're always shocked when they're caught, and they'll usually deny it, even when you produce the website that is like a carbon copy of their art. And but these are kids. They don't fully understand that. It's a bit too much of a coincidence. But this is a very big issue. This is a very big issue today. And so, what about stealing intellectual property in that regard? So this isn't an exact replica of the issue, but I think Ramosha makes an important point. So this is his issue he's dealing with. It's similar. So this is in Choshen Mishpat, the second volume of Choshen Mishpat, in Igros Moshe, in Lamed, in number 30. So it says as follows. So Hine b'davar she'elatehu, amasha shamba should be shivot matirin la'atamidim, lignovet teshuv l'shelot b'mevchanei asiyum, she'oseh hamadina...
Regents,
right. So there are some yeshivas that allow the students to cheat on the regions. They either allow them to get the answers, steal the answers, they give them the answers. And, well, I could do Lahonos, the Kabbalah, Latzitil, Shigam Rubatov.
But that's not plagiarism.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's not plagiarism, but I think the issues we'll get to are similar, the results. And by stealing the answers, now they'll do very well, and now they'll get into their schools. Kenidavar's at Aser. Lorak Medina, Demachuta, El Medinteros. This isn't only an issue of Dina Demachuta Dina. That's not just an issue of you have to follow the law of the land, and the law of the land is that you can't cheat on tests, especially tests like this. This is also a problem for Torah law. Why? Veins de Rak Nevas Das. This isn't only stealing thoughts, meaning, you know, the real issue of Gnevas Das is not that you're lying to someone. It's that you are purporting to be something that you're not. Right? The issue very often in the Talmud of Gnevas Das is that you allow someone to think you did something nice for them when you didn't really do that. So you're misrepresenting yourself, and sometimes in ways that will greatly benefit you, and that's why you're misrepresenting yourself, right? So if you lie on a resume, or if you do something, so now that's real Gnevas Das. So Enzirak Gnevas Das, Shagam ki Aser Kamar Shmuel Bechulin Daf Tzaditel, Shasr Lignav Dat Brios, Afil Dat Tashakum, so you can't do that to Jews or non-Jews. Vekoshkin Hacha, Shagnevas Das the Kulyama Afli Israel, and this is, you're misrepresenting yourself to Jews and non-Jews alike. Ella, dehu gam gnevas davar mamish, but you're really stealing something. So one day you're going to go for a job, or you're going to apply to a college, and you apply to a high school, and all of that will be based on the information you have. So this can be applied to, you know, cheating on the SATs and. I have to say that when I took the SATs, the cheating that was going on was rampant. Rampant. All around me.
What yeshiva?
It wasn't in yeshiva. It was a public... That, you know, you take it through the SAT. It's a little different for the yeshiva, the Shomer Shabbos kids, because usually the SATs are offered on Saturday, but instead for this also on Sunday. So it was a bunch of different schools all in the same room, but a lot of us knew each other, plus the Seventh-day Adventists that are always there as well. But, you know, people were looking at each other's answers, they were changing answers, they were, you know, it wasn't terrible, but, there, you know, there's certainly cheating going on. There was a guy next to me who was just copying my answer. And this guy got a score in his SAT that for the life of me... When we all heard his score, we all like, really? There's no way you got that score. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, nice guy, but wasn't the brightest bulb, and he got a score that just amazed us all. But he probably got scholarships because of it, you know what I mean? I mean, like, it really was a big benefit. I mean, I never said anything, but... I mean, he just sat there copying all my answers. Anyway, I'm glad I was able to help in his future success. I hope he put it to good use. So,
but maybe not, you know, because maybe he got a job that he really wasn't qualified for intellectually.
Right. Well, right. Maybe went to college he wasn't ready for.
Yeah.
Right. Or if he got a scholarship he wasn't really eligible for, then that's already theft. Yeah. So. So people are going to want someone who's qualified. For a year ago, they'll show them the piece of paper, you know, the degree that says it's qualified. And they'll hire him based on that. I mean, that's like lying on your resume. So, we don't get into all the details here, but basically this is his point, that I think this is a very big issue when it comes to the plagiarism today, especially in school, is you're misrepresenting yourself, you're getting grades that you don't deserve. This isn't a new age in the internet. This is an issue in schools everywhere. this was an issue when I was in high school. This was an issue when I was in college. This is an issue, you know, this is not a new issue. But I do think that with the internet, there is an ease to getting this type of information. Right? There's an old Growing Pains episode. I don't know if you remember the show Growing Pains, where the daughter Carol was really smart, and she like kept every paper she ever had, and her younger brother went to business of selling her old papers. Right? He'd steal her papers, sell them, and then people do well, you know. So he would so he got busted when some guy wrote a paper that said, "One day I'll be a mother," you know, and that's how they got busted. So you know, and that was all. So it's not a new idea, but with the internet, it's a lot easier. And I think in some ways, like the teachers have to keep up a little bit to prevent this. But at the same time, there is halachic issues in this sort of plagiarism because you really are misrepresenting yourself. All right, that's what I got. All right, thank you.